As you know, for this retreat, the theme for the talks is the Buddha's instructions on the four foundations of mindfulness. And I'm fond of the word mindfulness because of the second half of the word, the fullness part. And there's something, I think, very special about living in the fullness of our lives, the fullness of life, and that the way that knowing the world through our body, knowing the world, ourselves, through our feelings, mind states, and now today the topic will be the truth, adds to this fullness of our lives. And I take it as significant, though it may be just a colloquial expression, that when the Buddha began giving his instructions for the four foundations of mindfulness, he began with the word here. And maybe it's the same meaning we say sometimes in English. We're going to start explaining something. We say, well, now, now, and then we go forth from there. But he says, here. And I just love it that it starts with this simple word here. The Pali word is ida. I love the word, or even the Pali, ida. Every religion should have a word that ends with da. Jehovah. And Buddha. And Krishna. And Abba. And, you know, it's just, you gotta have a da. And we have our wonderful Ida. It's profound Ida. Omnipresent Ida. Here. Here it is. And so it's you know, there's at least, you know, there's something very profound about entering here. Very meaningful about here. And I was sitting here waiting to start, and you know, I was kind of noticing where we are here. And it's like, you know, this room is kind of special for as a meditation hall. And one of the things that maybe, you know, you haven't, I don't know if it's registered, how many of you it's registered, but we're sitting on a very solid cement slab. It's a really strong, stable foundation for us. You walk on it and it gives good support for the feet, solid. It supports us. And then we have this room that sometimes becomes so still. And this combination of the solidity and the earthiness of the floor and the ground and the openness of the space, the stillness. And then the sounds outside, airplanes, children. It's kind of meaningful for me that they're kind of like they're outside. Have you ever been inside a building when it's been raining and felt so safe and cozy and at home? And it just feels so good. The rain's outside. So all this stuff happens here around us. It's part of the fullness of the present, but there's also a kind of independence or freedom or stillness in the midst of it as well. And how often do we avail ourselves of here, of what's available here? How often do we notice? I know that I'm certainly capable of being preoccupied in my personal drama. What here? We're here. So we're here. And so, starting with that, we're cultivating mindfulness, a certain kind of fullness. One of the reasons I like fullness is that by itself, mindfulness kind of suggests like a little activity of the mind that you're going to apply or use in the control tower of the brain. You can be mindful. But where do you find fullness? Where are you in the fullness? In fullness, I don't know how it is for you, but in fullness, I'm kind of here in a full way. It's very nice, but I'm not exactly in the middle of it all. Somehow in fullness of the experience, there's no need to be defined or to be localized, to have a location. I'm here, you know, some local point of place. In fullness, you don't have to be, I don't have to even be located in time. Here. So, the Buddha taught the four foundations of mindfulness, and it begins with mindfulness of the body. I think a very significant place to cultivate being here. And then goes on to talk about mindfulness of the feeling tones, and then mindfulness of mind states, and then this mindfulness of the dhammas, which could be called the truth. And in this discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, there's a refrain, like a refrain of a talk, coming back at this over and over again. And it kind of, it's an interesting refrain because it kind of talks about what can happen, or the different domains or ways in which mindfulness can come to fruition, or the ways in which it's kind of usefulness in our lives. And it mentions three, and the first one is mindfulness can support us to be aware internally and externally. So it helps us to connect to ourselves and helps us to connect to the world around us. So when we're mindful of the body, it says, you know, you can be aware of your own body and the body of others, but this kind of, mindfulness doesn't keep us, you know, separate from the world. But it's a wonderful capacity to be present in both directions, inner and outer, depending on the circumstances. And one of the things that I've learned to do that I find very helpful is to kind of keep, like if I'm out in the world with people and talking, to try to keep half my attention with myself and half the attention with the people I'm with. And if I do that well, I feel like I'm connected and know what my feelings and thoughts are, and so I can be responsible for them and responsive to them. But if I do it well, then I also disappear in the process. It's like the sense of kind of being self-conscious can disappear. So, you know, so one way mindfulness is used is to help us be present in this world of ours. Not pulled away, but present for it. The second way mindfulness in this refrain is talked about is to be mindful so that we can be aware of how things are, aware that things arise and things pass away. It's a little bit different than being aware of impermanence, because the ability to see the arising of something and passing of something is a place where tremendous wisdom can be born, understanding of what's going on in this world. And, you know, Buddhism is a wisdom tradition. And as I said in the first talk, that discourse in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness keeps using the word understanding over and over again, to understand. So, you know, we can begin to understand this life, understand what's going on in a deeper way. And the fourth foundation has a lot to do with this deeper understanding, the uncovery of wisdom. And there's something about this simplicity of seeing something arise and seeing something pass that can give birth to wisdom, which I'll talk about. And then the third part of this refrain, and the way in which mindfulness can be helpful in our lives, is to help keep us free. And the language of freedom in Buddhism is primarily in kind of words of non-clinging. So that says specifically, to not cling. It helps us to not cling. But it says that, it says another thing which is very interesting, and that mindfulness, to the extent which mindfulness can help us become independent. So independent and non-clinging are worded together. This idea of becoming independent, not dependent. We can be interdependent with all things and still be independent. We can be interdependent and not dependent in a, you know, in the way psychologists talk about codependency or dependence. And so a very important part of what, you know, the Buddha was pointing to in the is which he talks about in the suttas is wanting each of us to become independent in the Dharma. So you become your own teachers, you see and understand and taste and know what's true for yourself. And in that knowing for yourself, not because you read in a book or because it's a teaching you've heard or because a teacher says so, but you really know. And the idea is to become independent in the Dharma, to be able to stand on your own two feet in the Dharma, but in the world, to be independent, not to be entangled or caught with what's in the world. And that's synonymous with not clinging. So to not cling to anything makes us independent. And then, but in this description of becoming independent and not clinging, it has a very interesting expression. It says, one establishes mindfulness just to the extent necessary to be independent and not to cling. And I think it's lovely, just to the extent necessary. We don't have to kind of like max out on mindfulness. you know, maybe you can imagine you're like the highest possible perfection of mindfulness. You know, how am I going to get up to that top of that mountain? You know, and here I am, you know. My mind keeps drifting away. But you only have to be mindful enough. Isn't that great? You just have to be good enough. So just enough so that you don't cling. So just enough so you can stay independent. And the idea is that it's possible. It's possible for each of us. And that what makes that possible is not something esoteric, it's not something complex, it's not something mysterious, it's not some secret teachings, it doesn't require a PhD in philosophy, but it's really the elements of our common life, the most fundamental and basic elements of our life that we learn to be mindful of, to pay attention to. Something very simple that we are learning, simple connection, just enough to connect to what goes on here in our body, in our feelings, in our minds, in a rather simple way. It doesn't require a lot of stories and explanations. I'm thinking of how reminded of how, you know, one of my sons was how he injured himself. Kids injure themselves seems like a lot. I used to think you were supposed to be alarmed when people got injured. And now you have to kind of, you have to, at least I think as a parent, you're supposed to at least investigate before you get alarmed. Just because someone's crying, check it out first. So injures his, I don't know what, twists something. So he hurts. And so then you go caring for the kid, and you go and you put your hand very gently, and is this where it hurts? No. Is this where it hurts? No. That's where it hurts. Very simple. It either hurts or it doesn't hurt. Very simple. Kind of a very simple distinction, contrast, that is a very useful piece of information to have. and helps us understand kind of more deeply what's going on. So in the teachings of the Buddha, he relies on simple distinctions over and over again. Simple polarity, to kind of, I don't want to use the word duality because duality has a bad rap in California these days. So, you know, you don't want to be dualistic. But, you know, it's a very simple distinction, pair distinction. And does it hurt? Does it not hurt? So in my talk about the feeling tones, there was this distinction between certainly pleasant and unpleasant, and then add this neutral thing, but also the distinction between the feelings which are of the flesh and the feelings which are not of the flesh, kind of sensual and non-sensual. And the non-sensual belongs to this inner world that can be so rich, so full, an inner world which doesn't come from, you know, being stimulated in the world or having things in the world go the way we want. And it doesn't come from the inner stimulation that can come from having good ideas. I've known people who feel tremendous pleasure from their ideas and solving puzzles in their head. And that's another kind of, in Buddhist analysis, that's another kind of sensory stimulation that belongs to the sensory world or the flesh. You know, to solve puzzles in your head or solve great problems or write great American novels. So it's inner in a sense. People tell themselves stories and live in fantasies. It's an inner world that, but it's not the inner world the Buddha was pointing to, which is deeper or fuller, which can have a tremendous sense of pleasure. It's one of the greatest delights of the world, you know, open up through this open sensing, this inner. And then when he talked about the third foundation of mindfulness of mind states, he continues to play with this duality or this distinction, this, you know, similar. And he talks about becoming, as Heather talked about, being aware of these different mind states. He says a person's aware of a mind that is characterized by greed as a mind characterized by greed. And a mind characterized by non-greed as a mind characterized by non-greed. So the capacity to know, is there greed in the mind? Is the mind quality, the state of the mind, the mood of the mind, colored by greed, or is it not? It's a very simple thing to notice. And is it a mind state colored or shaped by hate or ill will, or is it not? And the idea is you can kind of see these things, and it's useful to see these things, as opposed to where it gets complicated is all the things, all the philosophies and rationales about why it's important to be greedy, or all the reasons why you should be hating, or who caused you to hate, and there's all these stories connected to it. There's something very simple and basic and elemental about kind of going below the story and all the justifications or reasons, and the simplicity in here, now, not why it's here in terms of the past stories, but just, oh, here, now, there's this mind that has greed in it, and now there's a mind that's not in it. And there's something very significant also about being able to contrast that. And sometimes in mindfulness practice, you know, the emphasis seems to be always on be present for what is, what's going on. But in the Satipatthana Sutta, in this discourse, the Buddha also sometimes talks about noticing what's not here. Well, then you'd be busy then. There's a lot not to notice. There's a lot to notice that's not here, right? But so it doesn't mean chase after every non-existing thing that's here, that's not here. go through the list of no elephants here, no giraffes. You know, there's something very important about noticing the difference between a mind that's contracted or filled with greed or hate or delusion and one that's not. Have a visceral, immediate feeling and sense of that difference. So that when, if you spend time being greedy and then you're not greedy, get to know that quality of a non-greedy mind, how it's different. when spend time being having ill will, if that's been a theme for a while and it goes away, spend time getting to know what the absence of it is like. Because that'll teach you and inform you and help you understand better when it comes back or what's going on. You'll get a felt sense that there is an alternative. And there can be, and the appreciation of the alternative sometimes makes it easier to for the mind kind of to go towards the alternative. If it doesn't know any better, it doesn't. So, you know, some people are filled with contracted minds. And it's for them, it's ordinary mind. You know, this is like business. This is like, isn't this how the universe was built, to have a mind like this? And then it's a big revelation to kind of see there's another option. And so to really take in visceral feeling and sense of the other option is a real part of the education of this mindfulness practice. Very simple, just to see the difference. So a mind of greed, hate, and delusion, a mind without. He also talks about a mind which is contracted and a mind which is not. And to see that. I sometimes encourage people to do an exercise someday when you find yourself particularly calm, relaxed, maybe the mind is kind of very quiet, open, spacious, something like that. Just take it in. Let it register what that's like. Get kind of sense of what that's like. A visceral sense, a body memory of it or something. And then just, you know, store that memory away until the day happens that you get yourself wrapped up in a really good thought. You know, you're really involved. It takes a while to even realize you're really wrapped up and caught up in your thought. And then do the same thing for that. Let yourself keep thinking, but kind of get a visceral, inner kind of flavor, texture, sense of what it's like for the mind when now it's been caught up in its thought. And then compare the two. Bring out the other memory and compare them. I mean, sometimes you don't have to bring it from memory because it just, you know, it can happen quickly from one to the other. So see, and some people will report, there's many ways this can be experienced, but I've had people say that, one feels expansive, and when there's all this preoccupation with thoughts, the mind has gotten contracted and small. As Heather talks about the small mind. Some people talk about everything got dark. It was like there was a light before and now it's dark, like you got into a tunnel or something. You can feel the difference between a mind which is contracted and a mind which isn't expansive. So the Buddha says this, the instruction, when the mind is contracted, know it is a contracted mind. When it's expansive, know it's an expansive mind. It's possible to know when the mind is concentrated or stable or settled. And it's, in contrast, it's possible to know when the mind is scattered and just bouncing around all over. And so the instruction here is just to know the mind is scattered, know the mind is focused. To know when the mind is sublime or exalted and know when it's not. So to know when you have big mind, to know this. And this big mind, the exalted mind, the sublime mind, the expansive mind, is kind of like this, it belongs to this inner world that was that was being pointed at in the second foundation of mindfulness. And, you know, it's a world that we don't pay attention to so easily sometimes because, I don't know, it has no monetary value. You know, it's not like you go around trying to, you know, trade it in for something. And if someone wants it, sure they want it, but you can't, you know, it doesn't do you much worldly good to have inner well-being. So, you know, other things seem more important. But, you know, this is the, you know, to notice these things, to notice. And the Buddha doesn't say in these instructions, manufacture, make it happen. You should have one more than the other. It's a very simple instruction, elemental instruction, back to basics. Just notice how it is. Notice when one is present, notice when another is present. It might be you spend most of the day contracted, but then something happens and the children yell happily. The cavalry comes. You hear the cavalry earlier today? Bugle call. And finally, we're going to be rescued. And so something, you know, something there kind of, you know, opens or releases, and there's an expansive moment. And then the idea is to just know that, recognize it as that. Don't overlook it. So this is a long way to get to this, now the fourth foundation, the foundation of Dhammas, or the truth. And here also there's a polarity or a dichotomy that's forms the overall structure for the truth. And I kind of like the word truth because it kind of emphasizes this is important. And this, you know, important, basic, elemental thing. And that the dichotomy or the polarity or something that's being played out, that's being the heart of this fourth foundation, is that between being caught and not being caught, being in bondage and being free. Between that which causes suffering and that which liberates us from the suffering. Those two. And so the fourth foundation of mindfulness is to begin to recognize not just that we hurt, not that we're in bondage, but begin understanding and seeing what it is that keeps us caught. What's going on when we're caught? When we have the ouch, does that hurt? Yes, it hurts. But what is it that hurts? What's the causes of it? What's the conditions that makes that happen? If we're caught up in ourselves or tight or clinging to something, what is it we're clinging to? What is it the conditions that cause that clinging? And then if we're becoming free, if we're releasing the grip of the hand, or if we're freeing ourselves from clinging, what happens? What are the conditions that supports that? What allows that to happen? What are the insights that we have? What are the conditions for it? So that's the difference. And so it's, you know, are you, most simply, are you caught or you're not caught? And what supports that? What is behind that? What's, you know, what's happening there? To understand that, to begin seeing that. And the first three foundations of mindfulness kind of set the stage to see the truth. Because the first three foundations have a lot to do with getting stable, arriving here, understanding the value, importance of paying attention to here, what's happening here, having a little bit quieter mind perhaps, or more heightened mindfulness, so that at some point we're ready to see a little more of the inner processes that are operating that keep us caught or free us. So my task is to talk about the processes of being caught. So, and there's three different categories of ways of being caught, three perspectives on it, or three different ways that the mind gets in bondage or clings or gets stuck. And I'll talk about the first one, and leave the other two for some other retreat or something for your own, because it's some, you know, otherwise it's too long. And so the first one the Buddha mentions is the five hindrances. And those of you who have been on a lot of Vipassana retreats before know that probably this is the most common Dharma talk given on retreats, talk on the five hindrances. And if you've been to a lot of them, then when you hear that's the topic of the talk, you kind of shut down. Which is the third hindrance. Sloth. Usually it's called sloth and torpor, but it's also kind of resistance, shutting down. So the five hindrances are, you know, are universal movements of the mind, and we often like to emphasize that there's something impersonal about them, in that this is what minds do. So that when you, if it should happen that you notice you have someday a hindrance, that you don't take it too personally, you know, like a personal fault. Rather, you could say, you know, this is it. This is the human condition. Now I get to study it. And part of what we're trying to do in mindfulness practice is to be wise. So the practice opens up wisdom, is to help us understand better. Have the mindfulness help us understand this world better. Not just be mindful like a, you know, mindful like a, I don't know, like a video camera. Video cameras are mindful, they record what's there, but there's no understanding that's there. We also want to develop this wisdom factor. What's happening here? What's going on here? And so with the hindrances, the task of anybody who wants to meditate is to become wise about the hindrances. Without becoming wise about them, it's very hard, unless you do some kind of bypass thing or lucky or have an accident, to get or not have them operating and get concentrated without them, become free without them. And so there's something very mature about when you have a hindrance, saying, great. I get to understand it now. This is my chance. As opposed to, oh, shoot. If only this wasn't happening, then I know I'd be much further along. Well, that's a silly statement, of course. But the point is to be where you're at, not where you think you should be. That's where wisdom can happen and grow. So if you have the hindrances, the idea is to study them, to get to know them better. Stop and be mindful of them. So the first, so there's five hindrances are sensual desire. Though sometimes in English we just call it desire, just so it's more encompassing. Ill will. Sometimes it's called aversion. But it's aversion sometimes literally means something like turn away from. And sometimes there's wise turning away from things. But ill will is a little bit different, right? There's a little hostility there. And then there's what's called sloth and torpor. And then in English. And then restlessness and agitation. Though sometimes it's the Pali word has the word regret as part of it. And then doubt. Or indecisiveness. The first two, desire and aversion, I think of sometimes as the caffeine of the soul. And some people are addicted to this caffeine. And for some people, part of the reasons they get a headache at the beginning of a retreat, sometimes it's because there's not enough caffeine at the retreat, you know, real caffeine, but sometimes because they're no longer being pumped up or fueled by the caffeine of the soul, the desire and aversion. Some people live on desire. There's kind of always going, it propels them and want this, I want this, I want this, and kind of going. It's my bookstore mind. I used to, when I was in the 20s, I used to go into bookstores and leave with a headache because I didn't have any money, but I would... Every title, I was like, I want that. And it took me a while to realize I got headaches in bookstores until I saw it was a desire, just this incessant desire, wanting. And then same thing with aversion. Some people kind of get really pumped up with ill will and hostility and love to talk, you know, be angry. And, you know, they talk to other people who are angry and They pump themselves up, and you know, can you believe those politicians or whatever it is? That party, those people in that party, or, you know. You know, this kind of way of there's a lot of a certain kind of nourishment that comes from ill will. We nourish our conceit, our pride. We get puffed up. We nourish that we compare ourselves to others and we're better than them because you know. Or criticizing someone else. You know, there's a lot that goes on. The reason why we get caffeine, why we get energy from it. And it can be difficult to stop that if we're used to it and kind of living on it. And so it can be sometimes go through withdrawal. And sometimes that withdrawal takes a period of sloth and torpor. So you have to be patient. The desire and aversion generally have an object for them. Sometimes it can be a general mood of aversive that doesn't need an object or desire. But generally, you know, if we're really caught involved in it, there's some object, something that we want or we don't want. And then, as Heather said the other day, this beautiful movement of the hand that her teacher in Burma had, you know, usually the mind is going out and then turning the hand around 180 degrees and looking back. So when we study the hindrance of desire and aversion, we don't have to stop desiring and averting or having ill will, but we need to realize that the practice is not found in the object, the person we want, the person we hate. The practice is found in the subjective experience of having desire or having ill will, and then turning around, just feeling that, being there with that, trying to understand this better, being present for it more fully, and trying not to be seduced or caught in it and pulled off in it, trying to be independent, trying to be have mindfulness of the presence be strong enough so that you're kind of, I don't know if in charge is the right word, but you're stronger than the gravitational force of the hindrances. You hold your own and see it clearly and not be pulled into it and caught up in it. And sometimes it's a wrestling match. Sometimes meditation is not pretty. And that's okay. And there was many years ago, I heard Shinzen Young. Shinzen Young is this really wonderful Dharma teacher, kind of a Vipassana teacher. And he came. He was visiting us, and we were teaching a senior student retreat. And we asked him to give a talk. And he said, in the talk, one of the things he said was, sometimes meditation is like being in the rodeo. And a successful meditation session sometimes, the only measure of that, what that was a really successful meditation session, was you didn't fall off your cushion, you didn't leave. And it took all your effort to kind of stay on there, you know, and stay on the horse, you know, and, you know, it's bronking and kicking and, you know, all this stuff. And in fact, you know, and that's, you know, so sometimes it's wild in there. I don't know, or maybe not all of you, but. And then on top of that, we measure and judge ourselves. It shouldn't be this way. It's supposed to be serene and peaceful, and everyone else is sitting so still, and you know, you're about to bolt. And the fact that you didn't bolt is a sign of really good meditation. You kept your own. You stayed present. So the so to be very generous to yourself and just kind of see it, turn around, be with it, and be with it. But the instructions for mindfulness of the hindrances is kind of particular. It doesn't say only when there's desire, know it as desire, and leave it at that. It has some more instructions. The next thing it says is when there's no sensual desire, know that there's no sensual desire. So here again we have this noticing the absence of it. And I think it's particularly relevant when there's been a strong desire for a while and then it goes away. Take time to really sense and feel the difference. It really helps. One of the ways it helps is to really feel and sense the absence of it and get a visceral sense of it, is then you're more likely to notice when you start having it again. So if you really if you've really taken time to get a visceral, deep, such a intimate, close, full experience of having sensual desire. I mean, not that you go out and manufacture it, don't go look for it, but you know, if it just so happens that you sit and meditate and strong desire comes up, get to know it really well so that next time you can see it coming, you can smell it coming, the hints of it, you know, so you really catch it early. And then know what it's like not to have it. So that's a really a stable place, a real sense of knowing. And then it's much more easy to see these movements of mind between those and to see when you begin having a desire, when you begin having ill will. And this is seeing the... So the next instruction is to know the arising of desire, ill will, the other hindrances. Know how it arises. Know that it arises. See it arise. And see it pass. So begin noticing the transition between having it not having it, and having it full blown. That transition is really important to see, and that's where deeper understanding can happen. And so one of the reasons to become calm, peaceful in meditation, is not so you can be calm and peaceful, but so that becomes a vantage point to see the movements of the mind as they occur, see it in a deeper way. And so as you become aware of this, then the Buddha goes on to say, know the causes and conditions for the arising of the hindrances. So this has to do with the wisdom side. Because you're in the present moment, you can start seeing, here and now. It's not an analysis. It's not like remembering everything. But it's here and now. So, you might see, there might be something really delicious for a meal. And you're pretty content and peaceful. You're minding your own business and hanging out in your peace, and everything was good. And then you're visited, you're visited by the desire to have third helpings. And you see there's a desire for this, more of this delicious food. And then because you can see the arising of it, you might be able to notice how right then, what was the condition, what was the cause for arising it, for that? Maybe it was the pleasure and feeling the pleasure of it and wanting more pleasure. Maybe it was something psychological. Maybe you felt it's been a hard day, you feel lonely, you feel want some comfort, and that food was kind of comfort food for you. It doesn't matter if you're completely full, you want more comfort. And so, that's wanting comfort, wanting is a source, a reason why this, the condition for the arising of this desire. Wanting more pleasure, wanting to avoid something, wanting to get rid of something. You start seeing a little bit the causal world, and that's the condition for the arising of these things. And to see these things and see how they operate is a very important part of the wisdom factor. Because as you understand how it works, then it's not magic anymore. It's not mysterious. And it's not mysterious how you become free. It's not like, some magic that you hope to have. But the freedom can come directly from seeing what's there. Seeing how you suffer, seeing how you cling, seeing what you're trying to do. And then the Buddha, one more piece of instructions on the hindrances, he says, and also know what it takes to abandon the hindrance. And this is now going beyond simply seeing a hindrance when it's present as a hindrance, but also knowing how to help let it go, not to cling to it. Sometimes that just comes from very matter-of-fact, non-reactive awareness, just seeing it for what it is. Sometimes it's recognizing what we're clinging to. I'm clinging to that pleasure. I'm clinging to comfort. And seeing it so clearly that you abandon the desire because you see it's not for your own benefit. You know the hindrances so well, you see that there's suffering in hindrances. There's suffering in being caught. And just as you would remove your hand, if your foot steps on a thorn, a sharp stick or something, you'd probably, remove your foot or pull out the thorn. If you see the hindrance of desire as being painful, as being a loss of freedom, a loss of independence, a contraction, then it becomes kind of natural to want to let go of it, to not continue with it, to let it be. With desire, that sometimes is a much harder lesson to learn, because often desire comes clothed in pleasure. Like, desire fantasies can be very pleasant to have. And I've sat on retreat for way too long having desire fantasies of a variety of kinds, and, it's kind of basking in how pleasant it's going to be, or how pleasant it is to have these thoughts and everything. But luckily on retreat, they go on too long. And why that's lucky is that after a while, this is a drag. I mean, this is like a two-dimensional world. This is, it's kind of exhausting or contracted, but it takes sometimes, it's one of the benefits of retreats, you get to suffer a long time. And so then, then wisdom is born. You know? And because sometimes you there can be suffering and you don't know it because it's masked by all this, you know, the pleasure, the delight of what's going on. So, and sometimes I suppose ill will can also mask itself, you know, the suffering that's there. We don't see the suffering. So learning to understand, to stop and look and be mindful, to enter the fullness of the hindrances when they arise. Sloth and torpor. It's not tiredness. Good old-fashioned tiredness certainly can happen on retreat. Sloth and torpor, I think of it more as a strategy. all the hindrances are strategies. They're ways of coping with discomfort. When we're challenged, this is often how the ways the mind works. Some people, when they're challenged, go towards desire. Some people, when they get challenged, go towards ill will, blame, criticism, whatever. And some people, when they get challenged, shut down and go numb and just kind of give up and it's hopeless. And it's more like that, not just tired. And then some people, when they get challenged, they just run around in circles. They're agitated, restless. Or there's also this element of regret in it. We get challenged, then perhaps it's kind of looking back and feeling I'm inadequate, I can't do it, it's hopeless, I'm a bad person. And so this whole kind of complex that keeps us kind of bubbling and going. And then some people, when they're challenged, fall into doubt. And doubt is said to be the most dangerous of the hindrances, because doubt can cause you to give up practice, get up and leave. Sylvia Boorstein tells a great story of having doubt hit her on retreat. I think she came up, I don't know if she was the one who coined the term multiple hindrance attack. But she was sitting a retreat at IMS. I don't know how long a retreat it was. You're sitting a retreat there. And she had this multiple hindrance attack and doubt about it all. And she kind of went with it, believed it wholeheartedly. And didn't wake up from it until she was the airplane flying back to California. She left the retreat. She called. She got an airplane ticket. She left the retreat. And then, that was just a hindrance. I was just caught up in my, it was just doubt. That's a nice story, isn't it? And you guys are still here. So doubt can have come with tremendous authority. And one of the interesting questions is, why do we give doubt so much authority? And what I kind of like to encourage people to do with doubt is, if you're really caught in the grip of doubt, why don't you also doubt the doubt? Why is that the last thing that has, you know, that you're so certain about? this uncertainty, this inability to commit, this inability to go forward, to make a decision, this lack of confidence, lack of confidence in the worthwhileness of what you're doing, or not knowing what to do, what direction to go. Should I be with my breath? Should I do metta? Should I go for a walk? Should I sit? Should I eat? You know, what should I do? You know, I don't know what to do. And then we can get blinded by the object of doubt. Often doubt comes with, you know, all these stories and ideas about what we are doubt and what we're supposed to do and what's supposed to happen. And again, that 180-degree turn and come back and look at what does it feel like to be doubt? What's the subjective experience of doubt? Just to think that your task is to get a PhD in doubt. You know, great, I have doubt. This happens to people. And I'm going to try to understand this doubt, be present and explore it and be with it in such a way that I can help other people. Because this is not new for humans to have doubt. But sometimes we take it so personally, and my doubt is so important, and the consequences are so great. And so all the hindrances are subjects for study, for understanding. The key aspect of mindfulness that we're trying to learn to be present in a relaxed, calm, non-reactive way for experience. To learn how not to be for and against our experience, how not to manipulate it or fix it or run away from it or shut down. Just be present simply. This is how it is. That training can happen with the hindrances. As you do, as you notice the hindrances that come up, it's really helpful to notice them. As you notice them, they come up, then you can know that it's there. You can know that your task is to really know it well. You don't have to be in a hurry to get rid of it. Take your time, get to know it. And that sets up a very nice kind of data, in a sense, to have when you don't have it. And then you take in that, what that's like. How's your body different? How's your mind different? How are your feelings different when the hindrance is not there? And then you get to start, over time, as you get to know it better and you're quiet and present, and then the stillness of the mind or the quiet of the mind, you start seeing things arise and pass. You see the beginnings and ends of stuff. You see the transition of when things begin and how things pass away. And if you stay there and watch it, then you start seeing the cause and conditions around which things occur. Things don't occur in a vacuum. And it isn't analysis. It's not like you're trying to figure out. But you actually start seeing clearly. This is how it works. Oh, look at that. I have those kinds of thoughts, and this kind of desire follows. I have this, you know. And then we can also learn what it takes to let go. What's the insight, what's the understanding that we can rely on that helps us to want to release our grip, not be so invested or caught in it. And this has a lot to do with wisdom. Be wise about these things in our lives. And wisdom comes from familiarity. Wisdom comes from taking your time to get to know it, be present for it, not being in a hurry, not be involved in what's called sometimes spiritual bypasses, to get to some good place quickly. But to take your time, take your time. Go through, don't go around. Get to know it. It's very respectful of yourself. It's very respectful of what's going on to take a second look, to look more carefully. What's going on here? And so the refrain, so we do this, so that being mindful of inner world and the outer world. We do this so we can notice the arising and passing of things. And we do this just to the extent necessary so we can become independent and not to cling. Independent and not clinging to anything in this world. It's possible and it's worthwhile. So, the five hindrances, and tomorrow you'll get the other half of the story. So let's take a few minutes and just a few moments to gather in, check in, be present.